Vous écoutez en balado-diffusion le colloque Civic Freedom in an Age of Diversity, James Tully's Public Philosophy, présenté par le groupe de recherche sur les sociétés plurinationales. 9e épisode, conférence de Simon Chambers, Putting Reason Back into Reasonable.
To talk about, chew over, contemplate, think about the great contribution that Jim has made to political, social, and ethical debate. So I think, actually, Jim was my first political theory professor, and I think I might have been his first political theory student. Because I think I started as an undergraduate at McGill pretty much at the same time that Jim arrived as a newly minted PhD from Cambridge. This was not in the 90s, and it was not in the 80s. So, no more said about that. He did really introduce political theory to me. Some people, I think that I might get my political theory sort of genetically, but that's not really true. When I first went to study undergraduate, I wanted to study psychology, despite many people's kind of Montoya-esque advice that doesn't really mean what you think it means. And I went to psychology, and I got my rat, and I realized, true, it did not mean what I thought it meant. But luckily, I had taken a course in political theory, and sitting there, I said, this is what means what I really think it means. And from then on, I was hooked. It was wonderful to be a political theorist at McGill at that time. I think it's also, again, a wonderful time to be a political theorist. Actually, not just McGill, but Montreal is a wonderful place to do political theory. I was a front row commando. I would defend the Cambridge School as if my life depended on it. And Jim taught me many, many things. One of the important things he taught me is the love of texts and puzzles and history. But even more important than that, why studying these things matters, and that it's important that you understand why it matters and how you can apply it. And I do want to thank you very much for that beginning of my life in political theory, and I'm still going at it. But anyway, I should get to my paper so I don't fritter away 20 minutes reminiscing about the days at McGill. Okay, so today I want to talk about the concept of reasonable and reasonableness. The title of the paper, Putting Reason Back into Reasonableness, I was in a very Habermasian mood when I made the title. I'm still in a bit of a Habermasian mood. But I don't really mean this in a very strong sense. I really want to very kind of informally think about what we might mean by the idea of reasonable and reasonableness. We use it in lots of contexts in political philosophy. We talk about reasonable accommodation, reasonable disagreement. In law, we talk about reasonable doubt, reasonable persons, also reasonable faith. And these are not all identical ways of using the term reasonable. And I want to look at it in just one context, and when we talk about citizens being reasonable or reasonable citizenship, and what we might mean in that context. And in particular, I want to ask whether our ideas of reasonableness smuggle in problematic limits that exclude certain people or groups or claims or actions, and they exclude people, groups, or actions that really shouldn't be excluded. But something does have to be excluded, so that when we have standards like reasonable or reasonableness, it implies that there are things that are unreasonable. And it implies that we have limits and that we can point to things, action, and sometimes people and say, you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't say that, you oughtn't to have acted this way, this is beyond the pale, or what have you. So reasonableness also, and when we think about citizenship, it contains these ideals of what it means to be an active citizen, a participatory citizen, a cooperative citizen. And these ideals are very important, but I kind of want to look at the bottom end. I want to look at where the limits are at the bottom of what grounds we have to criticize. And in criticizing, when I say we criticize, we exclude, we don't actually, I think, well, we'll talk about what exclusion means, but I'm really talking about grounds for criticizing certain types of claims being made in the public or certain types of actions as being unreasonable. So in the paper, I compare Rawls, Habermas, and Jim Tully, and I'm just going to not talk about Rawls at all. He has a very technical notion of reasonable, for which I disagree. I want to talk about a comparison between really Habermas and Jim's idea of reasonable. Both of them use the terms reasonable, but they use them somewhat informally, and both of them, interestingly enough, are described as reasonable. And this is usually meant in a positive way, except maybe when Bonnie Honig uses it, but mostly it's described as a positive trait. That is, we like people to be reasonable, and to the extent that people like Habermas and Jim Tully are described as reasonable political theorists, this is a compliment, I think. This is something positive in the political sense. Okay, so some very preliminary ideas or preliminary kind of generic features of reasonableness. The first is that it is not the same as rational. So to be reasonable doesn't really mean that you have to be logical or instrumentally consistent. That's the first thing. The second, the way we use reasonable usually also doesn't mean that we need to be kind of critically reflective in the first instance. That is also, and not only that, we don't even have to be discursive in the first instance, because we can talk about reactions. We can talk about anger, for example, being reasonable. We can say, it's perfectly reasonable for you to be angry in this situation. That reaction is completely reasonable given the circumstances. So in the first instance, reasonableness is not tied to a high level of rationality or necessarily reason-giving, although I will argue that there is a need to be able to reconstruct it, maybe, giving reasons. Nor is it tied to any necessarily discursive or, I guess, notion of public reasoning, that we can talk about political actions, protests, for example, as being perfectly reasonable given the circumstances. But there always is given the circumstances. That is, when we talk about reasonable, it's almost always in connection to some context. And it often is a sense of appropriateness given the context we're in. And sometimes when we talk about that, one of the most common ways in which people talk about being our standards of unreasonableness within liberal democratic order has to do with distributive claims. So I'll just use a brief example here. So we're sharing 60 minutes. If I came and I said, well, I just want 50 minutes and you each get 5 minutes, right? In the context of an academic conference where the circumstances we end, this would be an unreasonable request. Another example of an unreasonable request, perhaps, given what we're doing, is if Jocelyn and Dimitri had invited us all here, and then they said, oh, by the way, we would like you to present all your ideas in the form of performative dance. So we might say, well, this is kind of an unreasonable request to make on us. It's an academic conference. We have certain expectations of what is appropriate. We're not really great at that. Okay, but what if I had, after being invited, said to Jocelyn and Dimitri, thank you very much, but I would like to communicate my ideas about Jim's work in the form of performative dance. Is this an unreasonable request? And here, there are a number of ways in which the organizers of this conference could have reacted. I mean, there's lots, but I'm going to pick three, and you're going to recognize the three. So the first is they say, no, we have the rules of the game. We all know what an academic conference is, and there are these expectations, and this is just, you know, I'm sorry, if you want to do that, you can't do it. These are the rules of the game. A second approach might be to say, sure. No limits. Anything goes. As a matter of fact, anybody can do whatever they want. Just, you know, you can't be violent or really sort of hurt anybody. But we have no expectations. There are no, you know, all the rules of academic conferences they're all up for grabs. We could all just dance. Or the third option is that we could enter into some kind of a conversation where they would say, well, why do you want to do that exactly? And then I could say, here's three examples. One, I could say, well, I feel like I'm a better dancer these days than I am a political theorist. So that's a kind of selfish reason to do it. A second might be, well, actually, in my culture, maybe you didn't know, but actually there is a way of communicating very important things through dance, and this is a conference dedicated to diversity, and it really, I think, would add to the diversity if I was able to express myself. Now, that's a more reasonable claim. Or a third thing I could say is that, you know, the fact that academic conferences have rules, I just think it's important that we shake up those rules, that actually there's something kind of good about just surprising other people. Not that I'm actually going to be able to communicate anything, but the actual coming up here and dancing, it's going to, like, people are going to go, whoa. So that one we have to think about a little bit, how disruptive it is, what we're really onto, and so on. Okay, so I think you can all recognize what these different things are, and we should really move from the context of the academic conference to the context of constitutional democracy. In the dialogue or debate between Jim and Habermas, Jim often accuses Habermas of the first type of response when it comes to democratic citizenship. That is, there are certain rules of the democratic game, democratic institutionalism, and there is an expectation. Habermas does talk about the self-limiting of actors, democratic actors in the public sphere. And there is this idea, I think Jim has, that in this Habermas world that the rules are set, and you can do lots of things in the rules, right, but you can't really challenge the rules. And then there are people who might read Jim and think that he's the second option. There are no rules. I mean, you can't, the only limits are nonviolence and perhaps a notion of civility, but there are no real limits when it comes to the relationship of appropriateness vis-a-vis the rules. But I want to try to kind of occupy the middle ground, and I want to try to argue that actually, even though you can read Jim over there, you really should read him here, and you should read Habermas here too, in the middle. So it is. This is part of, I think, something that's come up a lot at this conference, the idea of bringing together the party, two kinds of politics, the cohabitation that Dominique talked about. And I see this in Jim's work. Sometimes he talks about complementarity, but sometimes he talks about really quite stark contrast. And contrast can be very useful to talk about. And it is a style of Jim's writing to say there are two pictures, there are two visions, there are two ways of looking at it. There's the civil and the civic. There's the deliberative citizenship and the cooperative citizenship. There's the critical liberal versus the critical democrat. And these are all very nice contrasts. But sometimes the contrast is too much of an either-or, and sometimes it's more of a division of labor. So I want to endorse the division of labor view, which meets in the middle. But I do want to say that the division of labor view, which says we both need civic and civil citizens, and not everybody can be always both, I mean that there are some citizens who will be the civil citizens and some who will be the civic citizens, but that the limits on this citizenship are not just those are the rules, right? Nor, though, do I think that just the idea of nonviolence and civility is enough. That I think we have to have an idea of reasonable action that, so now I've lost my timer. Where am I in timing?
15 minutes. I wasn't timing because you said something you wanted.
I know, I had it going. So
it's 1:25.
So. Okay, so I have 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. It'd be reasonable, that's right.
How much time you want?
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to put my timer back on. Actually, I have seven minutes and 35 seconds.
Okay.
There we go. We're back on. Okay. I really like to be on time. Yeah. Okay, so this middle position of citizen activity and what is reasonable is one in which I would like to argue that the level of reasonableness has to be a little bit higher than just nonviolence and civility, but it doesn't have to be just play by the rules. And I think Habermas's view is that view, and Habermas does talk about the self-limiting of political action of democratic citizens. And the self-limiting is an idea that we don't put all the rules of constitutional order in question. We can only do it piecemeal. So it is a picture of citizenship within a liberal constitutional order, right? So it's limited by a liberal constitutional order. But that limit is only very general. And Jim actually says some pretty harsh things about these passages in Habermas about self-limiting. And I want to ask a question when we read Habermas here. And the question is a question that Jim taught me. And it was a very, very important moment in my education as a political theorist. We were reading John Locke. And we were reading Chapter 5 in John Locke about property. And we were reading McPherson and all this stuff. And Jim said, he stopped us and he says, okay, I want to ask you a question, right? You have to think about, what is Locke actually worried about? What's going on in his life? What's going on in the world around him, right? I mean, he's not really worried about proletarian, you know, parties coming up and asking for, you know, redistribution, right? What he's really worried about are absolute monarchs. So he is protecting property from that threat. Now, maybe down the line, if we adopt this property, it will also have the added, you know, of excluding redistribution or claims from the working class. But that's not really what he was doing, and we have to, in the first instance, understand what he thought the threat to property was, which was absolute monarchs. So what does Habermas think the threat is? Why is it so important to him that democratic action has a self-limiting function, that self-limiting is something more than simply nonviolence? He's worried about fascism, because that's the world he came from, and he's worried about populism. He is worried about democracy going wrong, and he thinks, actually, that democracy going wrong is a more serious and scary danger than having too many rights or rights being too restricted, because he thinks rights in, as a legal system, are things you can push back against in a way that you can't push back against the excesses of populism. And I think that when we talk about democracy and grassroots organization, and we have to always keep in mind that there's a lot of stuff that goes on in the grassroots that we might not like that's actually quite destructive. And one of the ways that he articulates the what he thinks as the limits of populism is the idea of having either a citizens who have the imaginary of rights. And we haven't talked about rights in this context or in this conference at all. And I do want to introduce it as a very important framing for citizenship activity. And I think if citizens do think in terms very generally of rights, it can have a self-limiting effect. And I'm just going to give a very quick example to close of this. And this is in the United States, the shift in at the grassroots level, the shift in attitude towards gay marriage. And we can look at it from the point of view of the civic and the civil. And it is true that, well, it does appear as if there were some grassroots kind of actions which brought home to many citizens that gays were people, they fell in love, they, you know. But the most important thing in the shift in popular understandings of gay marriage was the transition of this debate from questions of, well, what do you think about marriage, to questions of rights. So many of the people who now are okay with gay marriage, it's not because they think they've all come around and say, that's a really cool idea. They still have a sort of personal problem with it, but it got translated into the language of rights where it said, this is just unfair. You might not like it. You might not think, you know, the picture of it might like creep you out, fine, but it's not fair. It's a question of rights. And this was a self-limiting of the democratic population. So you see this shift. And the changes at the legal level, it's not really top-down, because the courts are actually reflecting a massive shift at the grassroots level of citizens' attitudes towards gay rights. And I think that attitude is one in which came to the core when their identity, when they started thinking about these in terms of rights, because that was the imaginary that was the self-limiting, or what self-limited them in creating this shift, that we're not going to go there because this is a matter of unfairness. So this is a very brief illustration to try to articulate how this idea of a imaginary or a structure or a framework of rights might be self-limiting. But within this, it's perfectly possible to actually challenge the rights system, the constitutional system, the legal order at all sorts of points. So that this image is not trying to, again, the worry is populism, not radical environmentalism, not anti-capitalist movements. All those kinds of actions seem to be perfectly possible and to be able to challenge the constitutional order without, though, thinking that it can actually operate without the constitutional order, without some kind of general notion that people have rights and that those rights limit what the demos can do. Okay, thank you.